Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Toyota's Kentucky Derby.
Every day, Camrys, Avalons, Solaris, and Toyota engines reflect the skills, ideas, and dedication to quality of thousands of Kentuckians.
Thousands of American workers are caught in the middle as Toyota's Tokyo Brass respond to the worst recalls in the company's history. Working for Toyota has meant job security in Kentucky. Now with sales down and stock prices tanking, it's a new reality. Turning Japanese, Kentucky workers look way east to find the future. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, February 10th, and The Takeaway is, you know, workers in the United States turning to the Japanese leadership at Toyota to figure out what the future is.
Well, you know, they have turned to the Toyota leadership before for guidance, but now they're turning to them for explanations. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning, and Toyota is in the headlines again. The company's recalling more than 7,000 Camrys for brake problems, and government safety officials say they're looking into a number of complaints with the steering on Toyota Corollas. With Toyota's problems getting worse by the day, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood tells NBC News,
"We will not sleep until all of these cars are fixed properly and are safe to drive."
Problems are not just limited to Toyota. Honda has added another 400,000 cars in the U.S. to its global recall for faulty airbags. Japan's number two automaker has been recalling cars since 2008. Today's latest expansion includes certain Accords, Civics, and Acuras.
Back to Toyota, though. This isn't just about consumers. It's about American workers here who work for Toyota. We're joined now by State Representative Charlie Hoffman, Democrat from District 62 in Kentucky, which includes that Toyota plant we alluded to at the top of the hour. Representative Hoffman, good morning.
Good morning.
So have you gotten to know Toyota management a little better, for better or worse, in these last few weeks with all the recalls?
Yes, I have. I've had quite a bit of correspondence with them. They're letting us have information because they know we're probably going to be talking to a lot of people about the recall, and they seem to really be earnestly trying to keep us up. Communications.
Well, we're going to find out how confident that makes Kentucky workers when they think about their Toyota jobs. Representative Hoffman, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Moving overseas, U.S. and Afghan forces have moved to the edge of the city of Marja. It's a major supply and drug smuggling stronghold for the Taliban. Earlier on The Takeaway, we asked retired Colonel Sam Gardner, who taught strategy at the U.S. Naval College, why is NATO publicizing this upcoming assault?
Part of the reason for the notification is to give mid-level Taliban a chance to turn sides.
There are reports that Taliban forces are dug in throughout the town. Here at home, a severe snowstorm is sweeping into the Northeast, bringing as much as a foot of snow to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia. Airports in New York and farther south are canceling many flights. Washington and Philadelphia each need 9 more inches to give them their snowiest winters since 1884.
Here's two economic stories. In Greece, flights are suspended and hospitals are operating on an emergency-only service because public sector workers across the country are on strike to protest government measures to tackle the country's huge deficit. But the country dealing with the Greek debt is actually moving the markets. European Union banks are organizing a financial rescue for Greece, and it's having a positive impact on Wall Street. New numbers out in the past hour show the U.S. trade deficit surged over $40 billion in December, the largest imbalance in over a year. Asian and European markets up, futures up. The Dow gets underway at 10,058. The S&P opens at 1,070, and the NASDAQ opens at 2150. Coming up, with the fight against obesity, one way to get people eating healthier is moving it closer to them. We're going to talk about urban farming on The Takeaway.
Today's a snowy day for lots of people. Lots of kids are having snow days from school, and we're wondering, what's your favorite memory of a snow day, and what should people do with their free time on a snow day? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. More details about Toyota and their workers in a moment.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with those parallel universes in the U.S. car industry. While Detroit was shrinking over the last 20, 30 years, there's really been a rise in the manufacturing capacity of Japanese-owned factories in places like Kentucky and Tennessee. Have you visited any of those facilities?
I have been to several of them before, yeah.
Nissan plant in Tennessee. There's a Honda plant also, and we were talking about the Toyota plant there in Kentucky. It involves thousands and thousands of workers. These are typically non-union workers, but very much concerned about their jobs and very much concerned about the recalls coming out of Toyota that have certainly attracted the attention of the world and have lit a fire underneath the Toyota management in Japan.
A fire that they have never had to deal with before.
Indeed. Well, you're dealing with it now. State Representative Charlie Hoffman, representative of State House District 62 in Kentucky, the home of Toyota Motor Manufacturing Kentucky, the subsidiary there. Good morning again, Representative.
Good morning.
And also joining us is Marianne Keller, an automotive industry analyst and consultant and author of Collision, GM, Toyota, Volkswagen, and the Race to Own the 21st Century. Good morning, Marianne.
Good morning.
What do you think the issue is for American workers who work for some of these foreign-owned companies, particularly Toyota, with all the headlines and the safety issues and recalls that have been announced over the last few weeks? Marianne?
I think that you have to remember that that the factories in the United States are assembly plants. The cars are designed and engineered in Japan. So American workers are, to some extent, vulnerable to decisions that are made far away from where they actually produce the vehicles. I think that putting it into perspective, first, recalls are very common. Automobiles are very complex machines, and most of us have had one or more recalls on our vehicles, and we just take them back to the dealer and get them fixed, because we expect that the manufacturer will stand behind the product and make the repair. In the case of Toyota, what went wrong in that process, which is normally virtually invisible, is the fact that the problems persisted over a number of years, and we can see that it goes back in some models, back to 2005 model year product, and they seem to ignore the severity of it, forcing a member of the DOT staff to actually go to Japan to convey the importance of this and the seriousness of it, is without precedent, I think. So I think that they failed really in understanding that they had a severe problem. They allowed the problem to get out of control, and then they frankly have not been able to contain the news around that problem.
Well, let's get a reaction from State Representative Charlie Hoffman. Marianne Keller suggests that there's not a lot of manufacturing done at your plant. You do manufacture engines, I believe, at your plant in Kentucky. And how much confidence do you have, given that Toyota management has really been sort of caught with their pants down here?
Well, we understand the gravity here, especially locally, with the plant lines closing down for about 7 days and no production. We realize that it is a bad situation. Now the line has started back up. They're producing cars now, and anything that happens at the Toyota plant here in Georgetown is big news here locally, because it is our largest employer. I think about 6,800 workers.
That's huge.
Yes, sir.
And how vulnerable do those workers feel? I mean, these are non-union shops. Marianne Keller suggests that you're vulnerable because it's mostly an assembly operation. Do your workers and do your constituents, you're a Democratic representative in District 62, are they telling you that kind of thing?
No, because the Toyota officials assured. And there were no layoffs during the time all the plants, the workers came to the plant and did basically housekeeping functions, I think, during that time, and everyone so no one had to take time off during that time.
And that gives you confidence that at least management in Tokyo is trying to preserve jobs. Marianne Keller, is there precedent for Toyota looking out for workers? Or maybe is there more of a precedent of them doing the math and being a little more draconian in how they preserve jobs?
What Toyota has done in being able to keep the UAW out of its factories, frankly, is make two promises. First, that their compensation is effectively at a UAW rate. So if you're being paid essentially close to something that a UAW worker at GM makes, there's really not a financial incentive to join a union. And the second thing that Toyota has made good on, a promise of continuous employment. And so Toyota uses quite a few temporary workers who will sort of fill in the gaps when production lines are moving at breakneck speed and might be expendable when they're not. But the core of their workforce, the permanent workforce, has always had this promise of job security through thick and thin. And it's very traditional, very typical for them to come in and do training and housekeeping and other sort of non-assembly type jobs during periods like this. You know, during model changeover, for example, there may be a week or so when the plant will not be running at full tilt. So this is characteristic, and this is how, frankly, they have been able to keep the UAW out of their factories. They're not the only ones. It's very common in most of the factories that don't have union representation.
Certainly Detroit has seen a radical shift in the economic realities of the auto business domestically. Are we likely to see a similar shift beginning with these recalls? Maybe it's not causal, but beginning with these recalls in the foreign-owned automakers in the United States?
I don't think that, we should be looking at Toyota and seeing that Toyota is about to go through, a multi-year slide the way GM did. I think that this has been a wake-up call for the management. They are a very, very effective team when it comes to engineering vehicles.
And we're going to see them in action because they're visiting the United States over the next few weeks. Some hopeful words there for workers in Kentucky. State Representative Charlie Hoffman and Marianne Keller, automotive industry analyst, talking about Toyota and the jobs that it has in the United States. Thanks so much. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on stories we're following.
The government in Haiti now says 230,000 people were killed in last month's earthquake. That's close to the number of people killed in the Asian tsunami 5 years ago. Meanwhile, the 10 American missionaries detained on child kidnapping charges in Haiti say the U.S. government could be doing more to help them. They'll be in court later today. The group's Haitian lawyer says even the children's parents, though, are opposed to the kidnapping charges.
Parents of the kids testify under the judge that they gave the agreement to the orphanage to give the children to the American missionaries.
Meanwhile, UNICEF says attempts are still being made to smuggle children out of Haiti. To combat that problem, specially trained officials are checking documents at the airport and the country's border.
It's snowing along the East Coast, which isn't news to anyone with a window in their house. Thousands of workers are scrambling to plow and salt roads as a blizzard descends upon states from Virginia to Connecticut. Hundreds of flights have been canceled. Kids in New York City have a snow day. A 3.8 magnitude earthquake struck about 50 miles northwest of Chicago this morning. Officials say no injuries or damage have been reported, although some people say they were tossed out of their beds by the force. Finally, the U.S. trade deficit surged to slightly over $40 billion in December, much larger than expected, and reflects an improving economy that's pushing up demand for imports.
That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we'll take a listen to the Beatles.
I don't have that album.
Yeah, that's actually not Ringo on the drums. That's bugs. That's real Beatles. And there's a way to keep the pests in check. It's by playing back their own sounds to them. More details in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
time now for some takeouts on stories you're following this week. And, of course, Congress is closed today and probably for a few more days this week because of the blizzard heading all up and down the East Coast. But Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, it's not just that's the not the only thing slowed down this week. The president seems to be upset that the process of confirming nominees has been slowed as well.
If the Senate does not act to confirm these nominees, I will consider making several recess appointments during the upcoming recess, because we can't afford to allow politics to stand in the way of a well-functioning government.
Todd Zwillick, what is a recess appointment?
Well, of course, as you know, Celeste, the Constitution gives the Senate the power of advice and consent. The president makes an appointment for someone in the administration. The Senate confirms them. But it also says if Congress is gone for whatever reason, the president can appoint someone during a recess. And that means the Senate is sort of out of the picture. These are very controversial. It drives senators nuts when presidents do this. You remember possibly that Democrats carped a lot when President Bush made recess appointments. In fact, John Bolton, former UN ambassador, he's been a guest on the show many times. He was recess appointed, and it drove Democrats crazy. Now the Democrats are talking about allowing the president to make recess appointments, and now it's driving Republicans crazy. Listen to Senator John Kyle. He's the Republican whip, and he seems to remember, you know, a couple of years ago when the tables were turned. Listen to this.
Democrats squealed when President Bush tried to do it as if it were something immoral and evil, and I would just ask people to be consistent in their view toward recess appointments. That was then, this is now.
Well, we'll see. Certainly not much is going to get done this week because of the snow. Todd Zwillick is our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Now let's move on to Beatlemania. That's B-E-E-T-L-E. Bark beetles. That's the insect sex. They've been eating away at trees, leaving them dead. It's a terrible epidemic, actually, out in the West. It's actually causing wildfires as well. We're joined now by Richard Hofstetter. He's a forest entomologist at Northern Arizona University. And I believe, Richard, you guys think you've discovered a solution to the bark beetle problem that's been plaguing the West for years.
Yes, we have been looking at some alternatives, and we are looking at how bark beetles communicate acoustically, and that has led to some very interesting results where we've been able to affect their behaviors and maybe protect trees.
Well, you discovered that beetles were irritated by loud noises, and you tried playing loud rock music. You even tried playing Rush Limbaugh.
There's nothing to stop any of this. Nothing stopping it.
But even that didn't scare these insects. What worked?
Yeah, what seemed to work is we manipulated sounds that were relevant to them. So we often targeted calls and sounds that they would make and play them back, and it seemed to influence behaviors. And so we were able to alter their interest in going into trees, cause a stressful environment, even sometimes kill each other.
So here's an example of a sound you're playing. This is the sound of their own, the beetles' bodily functions when they're eating at trees.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Really? It kind of sounds like a techno music underbeat.
I want to kill myself.
So Richard Hofstetter, why does this disturb the beetles?
Yeah, you know, that's the sound of aggressive male, and even when another male hears that sound, he responds in a very significant way. And so he usually will start to attack its neighbors. So, for instance, this male would attack a female that it's tunneling with and result in mortality.
Yep. You're starting a bar fight.
That's essentially, yeah, exactly.
You're aggravating the males so that they start hitting each other.
Yeah. And in this case, it's often the female that's next to it. Yeah,
I love this. So, Richard Hofstetter, you've provided an insight as to why Rush Limbaugh doesn't affect me when I hear him, because he's not relevant, right?
Oh. That's true. And we found that the music and human voice didn't really affect them. After a while, they got used to the sound.
Is this effective? Can this actually wipe out all these beetles that have been terrorizing the West?
Well, I don't know if it's going to wipe them out, but maybe it can be used for individual tree protection, maybe high-value trees. It's really a device that we're looking at for individual trees.
Richard Hofstetter is an entomologist at Northern Arizona University's Forest Program. He joined us from Flagstaff, Arizona.
I'd love it if that would actually work. Our final takeout is a conversation, actually quite a healthy conversation, started on our website based on a story we had earlier this week. Yesterday, you may have heard the story of Sierra Jones. Her story was part of our series, The Value, with correspondent Farai Chidea, where we look at how people have stood in the face of tough economic and personal times and made some decisions.
I was actually in my first year of college in Tallahassee, Florida, on a scholarship. model student, and I ended up pregnant. So I decided to come back home and stay with my mom and try to do school here. It was never really a good situation at my mom's home ever since I was younger. So eventually it led to them giving me a day to find somewhere to live.
Well, you can re-listen to the whole story of Ciara Jones's troubles and see a video of it on our website at takeaway.org, but you should also check out a conversation. Here's what Robert posted when he heard that story. It was awful. Yet another single mother, another child brought into this world under the worst possible circumstances. No mention of the child's father. No mention about the child. The subject of this story is not a hero, yet she is another woman who has advanced the decline of the American family in general and the black family in specific.
Missy agrees with that. She writes, I expected to hear the story of a young woman who made it out of poverty. Instead, I hear the story of a promising student who wasted her scholarship. Then she ends up in a homeless shelter and gets pregnant. I feel sorry for her, and I do hope she'll pull out of her precarious situation and go back to college to get a good foundation on life. But I must admit, the first question that popped into my head is, whatever happened to birth control?
Something that wasn't referenced in the story that we actually aired. But Pamela posts back, this is a bright woman who made some mistakes with little or no support from family. Who among us has not been there on some level? I commend her for empowering herself by taking advantage of the services and gifts that life has to offer. Don't you dare judge her unless you've spent 1 minute in her shoes, or anyone's for that matter. The point is that we learn and grow into powerful examples for women that will come after us seeking inspiration, hope, and help. All from that story.
Our listeners, yep. They have great conversations. They do. There is more responses. You can see those or join the conversation yourself at our website. That's thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the economic downturn has had lots of ripple effects. One of them is a slowdown in child support payments. Going to talk about that in a minute.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the recession has had all kinds of negative impacts on state budgets, on federal budgets, and on personal budgets where people are having a hard time paying child support. We're going to talk about that in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A second major snowstorm in less than a week is blanketing the Northeast. Baltimore, D.C., Philadelphia, New York City, all expected to get as much as a foot of snow or more, making it tough to commute to work and even tougher to fly. New York missed the last storm, but it's closed schools and canceled some flights at its airports. Add 7,000 Camrys to the growing list of Toyota's recalls. There are problems with the brakes in some 2010 models. On top of that, government safety officials now say they're looking into a number of complaints with the steering on Toyota Corollas. Earlier this hour, we spoke to State Representative Charlie Hoffman from District 62 in Kentucky that includes a Toyota plant that employs nearly 7,000 workers. He told us there haven't been any layoffs yet, but workers are worried.
Anything that happens at the Toyota plant here in Georgetown is big news here locally because it is our largest employer.
If you happen to own one of the recalled Toyota Prius vehicles, the company says you'll start getting letters with information next week.
230,000 is the latest death toll in Haiti's earthquake last month. The government says it's that high, and it makes the disaster as deadly as the 2004 Asian tsunami. And the officials say that death toll, as high as it is, doesn't include bodies buried in private ceremonies. Further confirmation this morning that Pakistan's Taliban leader is dead, Hekimullah Massoud. Pakistan's top security official gave the government's first real confirmation of the killing of the militant last month in a U.S. drone strike. Here at home, residents of northern Illinois were awakened this morning by a small earthquake. The U.S. Geological Survey estimated it at a magnitude of 3.8, enough to set off some car alarms, knock books off shelves, and jolt people awake at 4 in the morning. No injuries or damage reported in the Chicago area. Let's take a look at the markets. After futures were up all morning on news that Greece was handling its debt problem, the Dow opens lower this morning. It's down about 12 points. The S&P is down about a point and a half, and the NASDAQ is down about 3 points. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
There's a lot of issues associated with a recession. We've talked on this program a lot about the difficulty in paying mortgages, the problems with finding a job. Today, we want to talk about the Americans who've been unable to pay child support. In Tennessee alone, child support payments are down $13 million from last year. We're joined by a woman who has to deal with this in her daily life. Sheila Jones Calloway is a magistrate in Tennessee, and she hears about many cases dealing with child support. We're also joined by Carlos Jarrett, a father of three in Tennessee, and he's had difficulty paying child support for one of his kids lately. Good morning to both of you.
Good Good morning.
Good morning.
Magistrate Calloway, are you seeing an increase in cases dealing with child support in your courtroom?
We're definitely seeing an increase in cases, yes.
And what are are most of them coming from laid off parents?
They are coming from laid off parents. We're also getting a lot of cases where the state has generated petitions on behalf of the mother, or usually the mother, 9 times out of 10 is the mother, because she's having to receive state assistance. Whenever a woman receives any type of state assistance, they have to assess child support, and so we're seeing an increase in those types of cases.
Carlos, you pay child support for your 3-year-old daughter?
Yes.
And you're having trouble doing that lately. Why is that?
Just due to my income level staying the same, and all of my other expenses are increasing. Just everyday living expenses in addition to trying to maintain 2 other children.
So do you have 2 children that live with you?
Yes.
And you pay child support for the third. You have not lost your job,
No.
but your other expenses have increased while your income has not gone up. Is that what's happened?
Correct.
You know, I have to, in the interest of full disclosure, I myself am a single mother who receives child support. That's a check that very often I've needed a lot. So, Carlos, I mean, for those who are on the other side, this is an issue for both sides. This is not just an issue for you, but for the caretaker of your child as well.
Right. But at the end of the day, I think we all have to understand that we're all in this thing together. And on some levels, we have to be able to bend a little. I would think it would be a good thing if we could, you know, maybe reduce it a little and have it where we may be able to just kind of pay, you know, so much extra, because you know as well as I know that even with the amount that you receive, there are other things that may come up that you may have to call your child's father, you know, for extra. So in my situation, when that happens, that becomes an extra burden, and I don't like for mine to go without, you know, for, you know, all, you know, everybody involved.
So, Magistrate Calloway, you must hear these kinds of cases all the time. How do you try to balance the interests of these 2 parents, both of whom may be struggling, but there's a child in there that still has to have clothing and food and proper care?
It's very difficult to balance on many levels, as Mr. Jarrett has said, and as you have said as well. The bottom line is we've got to do what's best for the children. And I've told many fathers over and over again, if you have to do without, if, you know, as a mother, you may have to do without some things, but the child has to be taken care of. And if the child needs school supplies, the child needs food, clothing, the child might need extras, so that all of our children can achieve more than what we have, then we have to do without as a parent sometimes.
It seems like it would be complicated, though, because as you heard from Carlos, he has 2 kids he's taking care of at home, and he's saying that in order for him to meet the demands of the 1 kid who has court-ordered support, his 2 children that he's taking care of are sacrificing.
And sometimes that happens, and it is difficult. It's very difficult for the court. We have to follow the law and follow the guidelines that we're given in order to set support. And we are able at sometimes to deviate from the guidelines if we find good reason to do so. But a lot of times we just have to tell the parents that they're just going to have to either get a second job or just do a little more in order to take care of the kids.
So in your state, Magistrate, the state's collected $13 million less in child support than they collected last year?
I believe that's correct. Numbers, yes.
Is the state having to step in some cases where parents just can't make up the difference?
In most of the cases that we receive the collections for, it is a state. The state is stepping in to get the collections. And once again, it says if there's receiving any type of state assistance, whether it's they're receiving insurance for the kids through the state or receiving any type of food stamps or any type of state assistance, then, yes, the state is going to step in to try and get the support payments.
Carlos, you heard the magistrate talking about making sacrifices when the kids need it. Your plea to have your support payments lowered was denied. Are you able to take a second job?
Well, anytime you do that, they add more support onto it because of your income, period. So Anything extra that I do, I try to do with what I have. And as far as having a second job, that's just one of those things. You know, when you have two other kids to take care of, you can't get a second job because of the amount that it time that they require.
Okay.
So with that being said, second job is not something that I can do.
Carlos Jarrett, father of three in Tennessee. Sheila Jones Calloway is a magistrate in the state as well, both of them out of Nashville.
So all this morning, we're keeping an eye on the weather. Everyone's dealing with the weather this morning in the East Coast anyway. Much of the country is snowed in, but we've been getting some really good stories from all of you on snow days you remember.
This is Richard in Riverdale. In 1961, it was a snow day that convinced me God was a Democrat. 5 inches of snow in Bridgeport. Schools were closed. I got to see JFK take the oath of office.
That's a great story. But it turns out God is not a Democrat, actually. You probably learned that.
Oh, we confirmed that?
Yeah. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. What would they say? Ladies, start your engines. Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines. Actually, professional auto racing has figured this out long, long ago. There have been women in professional auto racing since the 1940s, but none perhaps with the profile of Danica Patrick.
Into turns 3 and 4. Danica Patrick coming out of 4. And boys, move over. The lady is coming through. Danica Patrick wins it.
So with her win in the 2008 Indy Japan 300, driver Danica Patrick became the first woman to win an Indy car race. Now she has her sights on NASCAR. This Saturday is her debut at the Daytona International Speedway. Joining us now is Scott Graff of WFAE, reporter in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
First of all, describe the significance of this debut. I mean, she's not the first. She's certainly the first to be as successful as she has. Scott?
She is. She's a very good race car driver. We'll figure out very quickly here how great she is and how big of a hill she has to climb in NASCAR. This is big for really both entities here. Danica is a good race car driver, as I said, in the IndyCar series, a much smaller and lesser known series than the worldwide known sport of NASCAR. NASCAR needs a little shot in the arm right now. That sport has been struggling, and Danica is stepping up to provide that. NASCAR, for her, is a bigger stage that she can continue to hone her racing skills and also continue to market some of the products that she does.
You know, I can certainly see the interest in NASCAR in pushing its demographic, and Danica certainly potentially does that. But her profile and her visibility isn't exactly a classic kind of feminist story. She's been criticized by even other women drivers, Janet Guthrie among them, for doing the kinds of sort of sexually, edgy. I mean, it's not that big of a deal, but still, she's sort of portraying herself as more than just a driver.
She is. She is has been called a marketing machine, and there have been comparisons made before to about 10 years ago, a tennis star named Anna Kournikova that was from Russia, came to the U.S., became a great tennis player, but really was known more for just being very pretty than actually how great she played tennis. And Danica has defended herself, and, you know, she's trying to be a little bit more than just a marketing machine here. She wants to be a very good race car driver. We'll see here in the coming days just how good she actually is. She's passed a first test. She raced in the ARCA race, which is kind of a minor league racing series, at Daytona last Saturday. She did very well. She finished in the top 10, and that's kind of opened a door for her to be able to race in the nationwide race coming up this Saturday. The trouble is, for Danica at least, the level of competition takes a big jump up this weekend.
If she doesn't succeed and really win some serious creds as a driver, does she end up as Kournikova? I mean, I'm looking at her spreads that she's done in FHM. She's got this GoDaddy ad that's controversial.
Well, the world is, this could be Danica's world if she can succeed in NASCAR. The stage is set for her to do very well. She's with a great team. She's racing a limited schedule, so she can kind of test the water, just dip her toes into it and learn as she goes here. Uh-huh. It remains to be seen just how big, like I said, the hill is for her to climb. Well, NASCAR's a tough sport to race in.
There'll be some more eyes watching, definitely, this weekend. Scott Graff, WFAE reporter in Charlotte, talking about the debut of Danica Patrick at NASCAR at Daytona International Speedway on Saturday.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. And coming up in a moment, how do you buy fresh groceries if you live in a city or an urban area? We're going to find out from one person who not only grows produce, but actually raises fish in a downtown Milwaukee warehouse. More on that in a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Move over Toyota. Honda takes the stage in automotive news today. The company has added another 400,000 cars in the U.S. to its global recall because of faulty airbags. Today's expansion of that recall includes certain Accords, Civics, and Acuras. Sticking with safety, the FAA is close to wrapping up a two-year investigation of violations at American Airlines. It involves looking at wiring that could be a fire hazard on planes. The result could be one of the largest fines in the agency's history, around $10 million.
Powerful storm coating the mid-Atlantic with snowflakes and high winds. The snow has grounded hundreds of flights in New York. There's a snow day for kids in the public schools. New numbers out this morning show the U.S. trade deficit surged to over $40 billion in December, the largest imbalance in over a year. For all of 2009, the deficit totaled $380 billion. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
First Lady Michelle Obama is fired up.
We have to act. So let's move. Let's get this done. Let's move to get families and communities together to make healthy decisions for their kids.
That is her kicking off her campaign called Let's Move. It's a White House initiative to fight childhood obesity. Will Allen was actually at the press conference with the First Lady yesterday. He's been working with local communities to help them gain access to healthy food. He's the CEO of Growing Power, a nonprofit urban farming outfit that teaches city dwellers how to grow food. Good morning, Will.
Good morning.
One thing that First Lady Michelle Obama talked about yesterday is food deserts, and we've been hearing about a lot about this lately. What is a food desert?
Well, my definition is an area where there's no real access to good food, where there are no grocery stores. We have a very dense population. Away up to travel, 3 or 4 miles before you get to a retail grocery store, with many people in low-income communities not having cars, transportation. It's kind of not very practical to get on a bus and go pick up significant amounts of food, especially for those families that have children.
And there's a lot of urban areas that are like this. I lived in Detroit for a long time. Many places in Detroit are a so-called food desert where people had have to travel a long way to get any kind of fresh food. How do you solve that? You certainly can't. It's a difficult thing to bring the people to the food or solve the public transportation part of it.
Right. Well, one of the ways, of course, is one of the things that we found in our work is that in every community there is a daycare center, a school, or a social service agency, and those places could become food centers where food could be dropped via CSA type box that we do called Market Basket, where we drop a bag of food, about 14 different fruits and vegetable items each week. It's enough to feed a family of four for a week with those items, and that's been a very effective way to get food into those communities, to really partner with those agencies.
So one of the things that you have done on your own is you've started this company called Growing Power. It's a nonprofit urban farming initiative. And what you do is really kind of amazing to me. You actually take old warehouses and industrial spaces, and you use something called aquaponic agriculture to turn them into farms.
Well, I bought the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee in 1993, and over the years it's grown to a national, international training center for urban agriculture and small-scale farming. So folks come from all over the country now to get trained in how to grow more intensively, because the fact is that we've lost a lot of our ag land, and a lot of our ag land is occupied by growing commodities such as soybeans and corn to produce mostly sugars.
Right.
So what we're doing is getting folks in the city to grow food, really take control and responsibility of growing their own food, because urban agriculture isn't something new. People have been growing food for years in their backyards and side yards very silently, but because of the dense population and the fact that more people are moving into cities worldwide, it's going to be necessary. It's not a choice. We just have to, if we want to eat good food, we're going to have to grow some of it ourselves and have farmers markets, farm stands,
let's explore that a little bit. Will Allen, of course, CEO of Growing Power, which is a nonprofit urban farming initiative. You know, this is way more, considerably more than just some, if you'll, you know, forgive me, smushy, just social program for neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods. This is a serious business model. There's a community garden right down from where I live in Brooklyn that's next to one of the biggest projects in in Brooklyn and in the United States, really. And they grow tons of fresh produce, and some of it goes to the neighborhood, but they also sell high-value produce to the restaurant trade in the city. You can actually make money doing this. Isn't that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have 40 employees, a budget of about $3 million now. We have a very diversified marketing scheme to get food to everybody, not only folks in those communities, but to be able to fund ourselves and create jobs. We're marketing to corporate cafeterias, to school systems, the Milwaukee public school system. We deliver food right from the same city, right into the school system,
but
restaurants.
Will, are there environmental issues if you're doing aquaculture? I mean, that can be some pretty smelly stuff if you're talking about ponds with fish like catfish and carp.
Well, no, it really, really isn't. These systems are natural systems, recirculating systems that cost a fraction of what commercial systems cost. For every gallon of water, you can grow a fish. So these systems are inside greenhouses and inside buildings in Milwaukee, and we're raising thousands of fish. And these systems can be easily replicated. Folks are coming from all over the world to learn how to build these really pretty simple systems that require one pump to move the water, and gravity and water pressure moves the water through plants. So it's called aquaponics, and it's a symbiotic relationship between the plants and the fish. So you get two crops. You get vegetables, and you also get fish.
You know, that Michelle Obama talked about her wake-up moment when she realized that she needed to take on this issue, and I can't help but think of your journey here. You were a professional basketball player in Europe, and then you became a district sales manager for Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I looked up Kentucky Fried Chicken, like a basic meal there. We're talking about meals that are about 1,000 calories or so a piece. It's not extraordinarily healthy food. And now you've come into this to do urban agriculture and growing watercress and fresh fish. How did you get here?
Well, I actually grew up on a farm right outside of Washington, D.C., on the border of Bethesda and Rockville. So I come from a farm background, went to college, played professional basketball, and wound up in Europe, where I got reacquainted with farming, because the Europeans actually grow healthy food the way we did when I was growing up. So that was my wake-up call, that something was missing in my life. And once I got back here, of course, I had going into farming is a very expensive thing, and I, to make a long story short, I took some corporate jobs, which for a time, and until I was able to purchase a farm. I farm 100 acres of my own farm, and then I bought this farm in the city.
And now you're growing food for the masses and telling other people how to do it as well. Will Allen, the CEO of Growing Power. It's a nonprofit urban farming initiative. Thanks so much, Will.
From the NBA to KFC to farming in Milwaukee. I love that. If you want to see photos of that urban fishery farm, aquaponics, go to our website. You can also podcast the show while you're there at thetakeaway.org. And today, since most of the country is getting hit with a blizzard, well, the eastern part of the country is getting hit with a blizzard, we're also thinking about snow days. Kids and adults are getting one today. Well, we're not. But what's your best memory of a snow day? On our site, Chris writes, snow days? Now that technology allows many people to work from home. There are no snow days. But then again, my pajamas are comfy. Anna says, I'm from Idaho. The best memories I have of snow days were when my mom would come in around 5 a.m. when the school district had announced the snow day to tell me I could sleep in. I was always too excited to sleep. As soon as it got light out, my brother and I put on our ski clothes and went out to play. Tell us at 8778 My Take Your Story or post it to thetakeaway.org.
And we want your nominations for who had a good week and a bad week this week.
My name is Daniel, calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. My nominee for who's having a good week is Jenny Sanford, who's been on pretty much every television show and in every newspaper for the past week. For who's having a bad week, I would say her husband, who's alone in the governor's mansion.
Give us your nominations at 8778-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. We're going to have that segment on Friday with our friends at The Week magazine.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.